KALW.
I'm surrounded by religious practices. The Black experience, there's a spirituality to that.
Today, one Black man's work to connect his faith to his community and to his fallen leaders.
The most powerful image or representation that I saw of Blackness and unapologetic revolutionary approach was that of Malcolm.
When your path to Islam means walking in the footsteps of Black revolutionaries. Then an Oakland artist takes on the issue of sex trafficking, inspired by her faith.
So that they know the difference between a real you are beautiful and I'm going to exploit you, you are beautiful.
And we get a lesson in an ancient language.
Ti shepeh mot in totk.
Ti shepeh mot in totk.
Perfect. That means thank you in Coptic.
Ti shepeh mot in totk for listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Today, we're starting our show with a spotlight on the KALW award-winning podcast, The Spiritual Edge. Their latest season just won an award for Best Long-Form Journalism from the Northern California chapter of the Society for Professional Journalists. They've also won awards for their earlier seasons, and we're starting the show with a story from the third season. It's called Becoming Muslim. Islam has a rich artistic heritage of architecture, design, music, painting, and poetry. Muslim poets like Rumi and Hafiz are famous for a depth and beauty that defies time. Today, that poetic tradition is still strong. It's kept alive in what many may perhaps consider an unlikely place, urban America, through hip-hop. The Bay Area boasts many Muslim hip-hop artists, including Oakland rapper Tyson Amir. Born and raised in the Bay Area, his path to converting to Islam came out of the Black American experience and Black revolutionaries. Reporter Imran Ali Malik has this excerpt from his story.
I don't focus a lot on what might or might not happen. We all gonna die. It's just the reality of the situation. But how are we gonna live? That is something that we do have some control over.
Tyson is an Oakland-based rapper, writer, and teacher. His path to Islam came out of the Black American experience.
I didn't have what people would consider traditional religion in my home. I'm surrounded by religious practices. The Black experience, there's a spirituality to that.
Tyson is talking about the Black American revolutionary spirit of the 1960s, but he's also talking about the spiritual struggles of his formerly enslaved ancestors.
What are we looking at here?
Tyson is carefully handling a large book. It's a family treasure.
This is the book that chronicles my family history on my father's side. So the title of it is History and Genealogy of Bartlett and Rowena Flemister.
Bartlett and Rowena were Tyson's great-great-great-grandparents. The bulk of what Tyson knows about his family history comes from the book he's holding. It was put together by his extended family in the early 1980s. There are hundreds of people listed in this book who all trace their lineage back to this couple. The book is hard-bound with green leather and embossed with gold letters. Under the title, it says, "I want my blood there on Judgment Day."
They put this on here because this is the tagline of the quote that they say my great-great-great-grandfather would always say. He would say, "I want my blood there on Judgment Day."
Tyson believes these words expressed his ancestors' longing to see justice for the crimes of slavery. The book is full of pictures and archival documents, and it begins with a harrowing tale of how Bartlett and Rowena Flemister survived slavery.
This is a very important story to me. In the late 1850s, Dr. Sweet, a calculating, enterprising businessman as well as a doctor, realizing a war between the states was an eventuality, began to sell his slaves. He sold Rowena and their oldest son, Charlie, for $1,500 to a plantation owner from Alabama. Charlie is my great-great-grandfather. So he separates my family right before the start of the Civil War.
For years, Charlie and Rowena remained separated from Bartlett and the rest of the family. When they were all eventually freed in 1863, Rowena and her son walked from Alabama back to Georgia, and by asking directions to the Flemister plantation, found their family again.
So then as the pages of the book go, here's the ancestry of Charlie Flemister. So he had 13 children. I am a descendant of him through his eighth child, Henry Luther Flemister. So this is my great-grandfather.
We sit for about an hour looking through the green book. I start to wonder how knowing this much about your ancestors' struggles would affect you as a person.
I can't tell you how many hours I've spent in this book because it meant and still means that much to me. I am waiting to be able to take this book from my father. He won't let me have it. This is my book.
Bartlett and Rowena's story survives because they lived to see emancipation and were able to prosper as free men and women. And their story continues to inspire Tyson and the rest of his family.
They acquired land, they fought to protect other people in the community. They were soldiers, bro. I come from that. That's dope. That's deep.
And then there's the detail in the book that is part of the reason we're telling you this story. By the family's account, Bartlett Flemister was a Muslim. This is remarkable. There were no mosques in the U.S. until the 20th century. It's only recently that historians have begun to uncover the history of Islam among enslaved Africans here. And yet, Tyson's family book shows that Islam, at least as an idea, did pass down through the generations.
I come from that, and that's such an important thing. The fact that my family has maintained, and I say that because I don't know, there's no way for us to really verify that, but that is the way that the story has been passed down to us. The fact that my family has maintained that my great-great-great-grandfather practiced Islam, that is important. I'm inspired by that.
Tyson and I are both part of a larger Oakland Muslim community. But before this story, we hadn't met personally. I called him up and told him I wanted to do a story about his conversion to Islam. He warned me that his wasn't a typical convert story. I guess he meant the kind where there's a single moment where everything changes. That's exactly why I was interested, I told him.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Next, we've got a story from the Spiritual Edge series, Sacred Steps. California reports more cases of human trafficking than any other state. And it's a major crisis in Oakland, where most victims forced into sexual labor are Black girls under the age of 18. Regina Evans is an activist fighting for these children. She's an Oakland native, a playwright, and costume designer who uses her creative gifts to call attention to this crisis and rescue girls. KALW's Janae Darden brings us Regina's story, and a warning, sexual abuse is mentioned in the story.
Regina Evans recalls how during a rough point in her life, the pastor at a friend's church prophesied over her.
She starts laughing and she said, I see them. Your children are coming. And she's laughing and she's happy. And she's like, your children are coming. And I was like, whose children are coming?
The children came, all right. Regina didn't birth them, but she's giving new life to some Oakland youth who've endured unimaginable ordeals. Regina and I are on the intersection of International Boulevard and 21st Avenue in East Oakland. It's a warm Thursday, just on the eve of a heat wave. Regina is in all black flowy pants and shirt with a multicolored African wrap crowning her head. Around here are apartments, convenience stores, an elementary charter school, and trafficked youth roaming the streets. Regina says this intersection is part of a longer 2.5 mile stretch of road people in Oakland call the track.
And the track is where girls are and boys are sold into rape for sale.
Oakland is in Alameda County, whose officials report that 99% of sex trafficking victims are girls and 63% are black. Art is one way 59-year-old Regina reaches these young victims. Several times a year, Regina gathers volunteers to help her create altars on different areas of the track. She's not conventionally religious, Regina's faith is a spiritual gumbo that honors her Protestant upbringing, West African spiritual traditions, the divine feminine, and the power of dreams. This visual gift for sexually exploited girls originated in her dreams.
And I saw the track as a garden. And I woke up and I was like, what? And I was like, oh, we're supposed to change the track into a garden. It was that clear. And I was like, I'll build garden altars.
Regina and her crew brighten up blighted corners. Donors deliver green plants as offerings for the altars. Volunteers buzz around the sidewalks with plush dining room chairs, sunflowers, and African dolls. I'll say more about the symbolism later, but this is for all the altars, one for each corner at 21st Avenue and International Boulevard. Regina calls this intersection the belly of the beast. On any given night, 10 to 15 girls here are victims of trafficking.
Once it gets about 9:30, there's so many young women out here. Like on the track, this is the hottest block, right here. So you already see some girls out.
Across the street, two slim young black girls in super short shorts, sheer tops, and long colorful wigs float in the street alongside parked cars. Oakland police officials tell me about 35% of trafficked youth in Oakland are from the city. Most of the rest come from nearby areas. Regina says exploiters force kids into sex labor many ways. She knows a common tactic involves grooming. Traffickers hang out in places where kids are vulnerable, near foster care homes and in front of high schools. They charm the girls with gifts, and soon things get sexual. The girls are smitten, thinking the exploiter is their boyfriend. So when he asks for a favor, like having sex with someone for money to help him out, they do it. The exploiter turns violent if a girl doesn't want to work for him anymore. Then, Regina says, the exploiters got them, mentally and physically.
The line that they use the most to grab a girl is, you are beautiful. We are falling down on our job when that's the line from an exploiter.
That's a major reason why Regina creates these art installations that encourage the girls to seek validation from within themselves.
So that they know the difference between a real you are beautiful and a fake ass, because I'm going to exploit you. You are beautiful.
As they set up the altars, volunteers keep a lookout for girls to help.
Wait, did I speak to that young lady?
I looked and they tried to make eye contact. She looked away. So, yeah.
They're not trying to be bothered, but it's okay. They know we're here. Yeah, that's the main thing.
Regina knows firsthand what these girls are going through because she experienced it too.
These young people are in sexual slavery. Let's be clear, it is slavery.
Amara Tabor Smith is an artist who helps Regina with the children she rescues. Amara says people confuse sex trafficking with prostitution. Prostitution is when one is a willing participant in sex work. The U.S. State Department calls sex trafficking a modern form of slavery, where exploiters use force, fraud, or coercion to traffic people into sex labor. Amara, Regina, and others who work to emotionally and physically liberate trafficked girls identify themselves as abolitionists.
The rescue work is about how does this young person get on their feet?
Regina works her connections. She finds housing for survivors. She'll alert the police about extra shelter beds and link youth to organizations where they'll be safe. She helps them find jobs and food.
A lot of them need, you know, they need mental health resources because of the amount of trauma. That's where Regina has been really, like, her work is really powerful.
I reached out to survivors Regina has helped. For their safety, they declined being interviewed. But I noticed they affectionately refer to Regina as Mama Regina. Amara says the youth do this out of trust.
Regina has been consistent, unrelenting in, I'm here. I'm here if you need to talk, you need to stop by. You know, her personality is such that she's both an elder, but also there's something eternally youthful about her. She's Mama Regina, but she's also right there with you.
The Those were excerpts from KALW's multiple award-winning podcast, The Spiritual Edge. You can find all four seasons, from Sacred Steps to Becoming Muslim to A Prayer for Salmon, all online at kalw.org/spiritualedge. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Unlike many people who celebrate Christmas on December 25th, Coptic Christians are an Orthodox Christian sect, and they adhere to an older calendar that recognizes Christmas Day on January 7th, yesterday. The majority of Coptic churches in the country are here in California, and one of the oldest is nestled in the Hayward Hills, St. Antonius Coptic Church. Egyptian Coptic immigrants established it back in 1976. Over the past decades, Egyptian Copts have come to the U.S., many fleeing discrimination and violence back home. Just as they're a minority in their homeland, they're a minority here too. So the church has become more than a place of worship. It's a crucial part of preserving the Coptic language and heritage as immigrant families raise new generations of American kids. So today we're re-airing a story from when I visited San Antonius to experience a day at a Coptic church. I walk in on a Sunday morning, and about 150 people are standing in prayer behind red velvet pews, men on one side, women on the other, some covering their heads with white lace scarves. All heads are bowed as the priest leads them in a hymn. They start in English, then they switch to Arabic, their spoken language back home in Egypt. And then a switch even further back. This is Coptic, the language spoken by Egyptians until the 7th century. It evolved from Greek and Demotic. Demotic goes back to 2000 BC and traces its roots to the Egyptian language of the Pharaonic era that was written in hieroglyphics. Head deacon George Basilio says the language is a cornerstone of a heritage they're trying hard to preserve.
It's the very, very ancient language of the Egyptians. The Copts are those original inhabitants of Egypt that have used this language for many, many, many years before the conquest of the Arabs, and then now we've converted to the Arabic language as the language of the state.
Coptic is not really spoken today. It's now more of a liturgical language, and this is one of the few places in America you'd hear it. The ancient hymns echo off walls adorned in gold and red drapery with life-size paintings of Coptic saints, the Virgin Mary, and Jesus Christ. Altar servers stand chanting in the front of the room, facing one another in two lines, swaying while playing finger cymbals and tambourines. Meanwhile, the bishops wear white embellished robes and tall white papal head coverings with crosses. Bishop Bishoy Ray, the head of the church, addresses the congregation in interchangeable English and Arabic. Everyone here calls him Abuna, which means our father in Arabic.
Prepare yourself, Santa will come for your kids during maybe this week, at most the next week. I hope.
After receiving communion, everyone goes out to the hall for some coffee and cake, vegan cake, because they are in days of fasting. For when they're not fasting, there's a little shop where they can buy Egyptian sausages and cheeses from back home. Sharing food is a big part of Coptic culture. Mary Allen has been coming here for 33 years and drives over every week from Redwood City. She hands me a round piece of bread about the size of my hand.
There is special people in the church. They make it every week. They come the night before, and they pray on the bread, and it's ready in the morning for everybody.
I'm going to bite into it. So what significance does this have that I'm eating the bread?
You're getting blessed.
I'm getting blessed. Yeah. Today, there are 450 families. A group of just 20 families started this Coptic community back in 1975. Back then, Bishop Ray says, things in Egypt were peaceful. Muslims and Christians lived side by side as neighbors. He recalls one day in college when he was over at a Muslim friend's house studying.
His mom knew that I'm fasting. So she started to do fasting, vegetarian food for me, especially for me, because I'm fasting. And while we're studying, he excused himself to pray, and I excused myself to pray or read in the Bible. So we're in very harmony, lovely.
But the recent influx of Copts is a sign of darker times. Following the ouster of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi in 2013, Coptic churches and homes were attacked by mobs. Bishop Ray says the violence is foreign to them.
It's very strange. It's not a nature of Egypt or Egyptian. It's something different. We heard about it in other countries, but in Egypt, never ever.
Over the past 3 years, he's seen his congregation more than double. Whole families emigrated, all gravitating towards this church. Kids of all ages came as English language learners, trying to fit in, including Pavli Farag, who emigrated with his family when he was 10. Now he's a well-spoken 16-year-old and says being a Coptic teen in America is challenging. Egypt is a conservatively cultured society, and Orthodox Copts are even more conservative than the mainstream. Drinking is frowned upon, even for adults. Much of the popular music is shunned as inappropriate, and no dating.
Temptations are pretty tough to deal with. It's not easy, and I have a lot of stuff to still work on, for sure, yeah.
And then there's the fasting. There are 210 days of fasting in a year. Like right now, as Farag observes the 43-day fast before Christmas.
So it's kind of hard to, like, when you go out with your friends to, like, to abstain from, like, the dairy and all the dairy food and just stick to the fasting rules. So that I find that kind of tough at times.
So when Bishop Ray was given the choice of either growing the church into a cathedral or building a youth center, he recalled words from the church's highest priest in Egypt.
His Holiness Bob Shenouda always said, church without youth is a church without future.
So he opened a Coptic youth center, a place where the kids can socialize within the community. Today, about 50 kids in colorful tees and shorts are playing basketball in the center's gym.
My name is Philip Petir Serafim, and the best thing about coming to church, well, you pray for God and you just forgive him for all the bad things you did in your life.
His life of 9 years so far. There are other reasons to come to the church, he says.
You can just have fun with your friends, have a good time. It's really good. You should actually stay, actually.
And I do.
Nobody guarding, because we're not playing man-to-man. We said play man-to-man, okay? Deal? Let me guard someone. Tell me who you're guarding now, and then go.
I interrupt the huddle to talk with more of the kids.
My name's Andrew Abu-Sad. I like to come to church because I can pray and confess, and after that, I like to play with my friends.
What do you confess to? What is there to confess to?
Sometimes, like when I say bad words and I get in fights, a boon of praise on you, and then that means you don't do it again.
Oh, and about Christmas? 11-year-old Brenna Banoub explains.
Ours is on January 7th.
So what do you do when everybody's celebrating on the 25th, but you're celebrating on the 7th?
Well, my family celebrate on both days. Like, we open our gifts on the 25th, but we come to church and have family over on the 7th.
So they get to have two Christmases. This is one of the things the church has decided to be flexible about. It's a necessary part of living in America, says Ismat Abdul Malik, one of the founders of the church.
The more the merrier. We celebrate the birth of our Lord twice. As long as you're remembering the reason for the season, that's what counts.
I leave the kids to their game, the parents to their Sunday afternoon mingling. But before I leave, I ask Deacon Basilios for a quick language lesson in Coptic to do my part in preserving this ancient language.
I can teach you maybe a sentence that says, O King of Peace, grant us your peace, establish upon us your peace, and forgive us our sins.
Oh no, that's long.
That's long, okay. I can teach you to say thank you.
Okay.
How is that?
Thank you is perfect.
Thank you is perfect. Ti shepehmot entotk.
Ti shepehmotk entotk.
Perfect. That means thank you in Coptic. Ti shepehmot entotk.
Ti shepehmot entotk.
Perfect.
All of that is just thank you?
Yes. That's too much. Yeah, but that's you just spoke Coptic. That's
Yay,
Coptic. Yes.
That story first aired in 2012. You can do your part in preserving the language, too. We've got a lesson in Coptic language at kelw.org/crosscurrents. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We learn why a game that unites people from around the Bay Area and beyond is becoming harder to organize.
And definitely in terms of, like, the situation where you could just go to the park and play. That seems harder to find.
It's a new story from our series, Culture Keepers. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News. Today's Cross Currents team includes Sarah Jesse, Lena Nagia Basuni, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tenz, Shirin Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.